call our second case for today, 2012-AP-2784, 118th Street, Kenosha, LLC versus the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Attorney Abigail Potts, Assistant Attorney General, will represent the state of Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Charles P. Grautner represents 118th Street, Kenosha, LLC. Ms. Potts, you have 25 minutes for your argument, and then 5 minutes rebuttal. Mr. Grautner, you get 30 minutes. Ms. Potts, you may proceed. A picture is worth many words, if I could read and understand the pictures. They're the Google Maps that you got in your briefs?
That's correct, yes. Okay. May it please the Court, my name is Abigail Potts. As you said, I represent the Wisconsin Department of Transportation in this case. And before I really start, I'll explain the photographs here up in front.
Mr. Grautner, do you have any objection to? Okay. You may proceed.
Okay. These are the photographs, just the satellite photographs of the subject parcel that were included in our opening brief in this case.
Are they in the record?
They are not in the record.
Okay.
So they're just kind of for, we offer them only to kind of help explain the case as we go along here and answer questions. This is an eminent domain appeal that involves an acquisition called a temporary limited easement, or a TLE. The state acquired a TLE in this case to very briefly occupy a small portion of the plaintiff's property to reconfigure a driveway. But what this case is really about is the plaintiff's attempt to use that TLE to get compensation for a non-compensable act of police power, in this case, the vacating and relocating of 118th Avenue.
May I, from the very beginning, both sides, I need you to really clarify for me what exactly is the plaintiff's claim and what exactly are you seeking in damages and how exactly do you get there? Is it limited to a 3209 statutory claim? Is there some sort of as-applied analysis that the relief in the statute, if it doesn't give you what you're looking for, then you deserve compensation differently? Is there any sort of just non-statutory takings claim that is being brought here? Because to me, I'm trying to figure out if we're conflating certain doctrines and principles to get relief or if they really are standalone. Here's the claim, here's the damage. Here's the claim, here's the damage. So I'm just going to ask that so that both sides can try to lay that out for me as to legally, claim damages, claim damages.
Well, I'll let Mr. Grautner speak to that when he comes up too. But from my perspective, this is an appeal of an award of damages for a temporary limited easement. So it is a case that was brought under 3209.
Only.
Okay. And that's kind of one of our points in this case is that they are trying to get something they can't get through the process.
How much did your people? That is, your witnesses say the claim.
I'm sorry.
How much did you want to pay for the TLE?
I think it was $20,000.
Okay.
Roughly.
All right.
It's in the
and
record.
It was for the TLE and nothing else.
Correct.
That's one answer to Justice Ziegler.
Correct. Yep, and that's what's being appealed. Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
And the other side said you want the TLE, that is this temporary easement, plus permanent damage or permanent taking because you didn't have the same kind of access to 118th Street. Is that the point? And that was worth $400,000.
Right. Actually, I think what the plaintiffs are saying is that they would acknowledge that they are only seeking compensation for the TLE, but it's their opinion that when valuing a TLE,
okay,
you have to bring in all these other damages caused by different, we would say, different phases
all
or
right.
different aspects.
You get there the same way.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
So, do you have a question?
Yeah, I want to get to exactly what is involved here. The first thing I want to know is this, let's see, what do we call it, a limited access this, what's it, limited access highway? Is this under?
This is not.
Is it under either 8529 or 8525?
25. No, it's not. So that is a separate type of police power case where whenever you're dealing with a controlled access highway. But this is not that type of case. This is a different type of police power case. And there's really two points that I want to start out by making here to kind of focus where we want to go. And it is, first of all, that this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the circuit court's findings and holding that these, the two acts that we're going to talk about here, the temporary limited easement we took to reconfigure a driveway and the vacating of 118th Avenue are two separate acts. And that's where the circuit court stopped and where I think this court can stop as well. And therefore, any alleged damages that that were caused by removing 118th Avenue were properly excluded from the process of valuing the small temporary limited easement that we took.
Well, and can they ever get paid for that?
They've already been, well, we gave them an offer that they appealed.
No. Can they ever get paid because they no longer have access to 118th Avenue?
Did they get paid for that?
They ever get paid.
Well, can they ever get paid?
You didn't want to pay them for that.
Correct. And it would depend on the facts of the situation. In this case, they can't get paid for that because
they
we didn't
take
any. They
can or cannot?
Cannot.
Why not?
Because that act is something that the state has authority to do under its police powers and under Chapter 84. And there was no actual taking in this case that was related to removing that road. So in some cases, what will happen is you'll see maybe a road get moved, but in the process of that, they will take some of the plaintiff's property permanently to achieve that goal.
Where in Chapter 84 is the police power, and how is it exercised in this case? And what is the significance, and it's all part of the same question, of your Exhibit A?
Exhibit A, from our opening brief?
From your opening brief, which relates to national system of interstate highways under Section 8429, which you said wasn't applicable.
Correct. Yep. So to answer the first part of your question, the authority in 84 gives us the authority to actually move the road.
So you have general legislative
general authority
to remove any road. It's not this specific road.
Right. And we have a couple different sources of authority in Chapter 84. We have kind of a general authority, and then we also have in 84.29, a more specific authority which relates to the document that you've identified, Exhibit A. And this document basically shows that back way before this project even began, this area was deemed to be part of the National System of Interstate Highways. And that gives us additional authority under 84.29 to actually vacate a road. And it also, in that process of making that designation, there was a finding that putting this road system in this area under that authority was a benefit to the public welfare.
Okay, so you exercised your argument is you exercised police power under Chapter 84, more specifically, falls under 8429, and I assume to exercise the police power, you had to have hearings of some sort.
The record in this case really doesn't speak to what was done before we vacated the road because this, again, and Justice Ziegler kind of pointed this out, this case is an appeal of a temporary limited easement. So the record in this case is really limited to what we did to borrow their land for a little bit down on the bottom to redo their driveway. So that really confines this inquiry here. And so we don't have all the documents we would like to have.
Oh, but the Hastings case indicates that the court can take judicial notice that procedures were had under various statutes, even though they were not part of the record.
Okay. Yeah. I can't tell you what was actually done in this case. What I do know is, you know, we have that designation back in the 50s for the, you know, National System of Interstate Highways, so that had one finding of you know, in support of the public welfare that gave the state a little bit more authority to do certain things. We don't have, and I don't have enough information with you today, and this case really isn't about what was done in preparation for vacating that road. this case is really about is how we value a temporary limited easement. And even if this court finds that the circuit court abused its discretion in making its finding these were two separate acts, which is what the circuit court found, and stopped there, if this court finds that those findings are an abuse of discretion, we would still ask this court to make a finding that when valuing a temporary limited easement, when we come on someone's property and we just borrow it, we don't change the boundaries at all. We're simply parking our vehicles there and doing some work and then leaving. So when valuing a temporary limited easement, it's our position that the proper method for valuing that type of temporary taking is by determining rental values. And
first,
not
just
to,
before you get into valuation, I want to go back to the easement that you took temporarily. And you took that easement because when you moved the road, you took away an access to this property that was off of 118, correct?
Sorry, state that again.
Yeah. You took this temporary easement because when you moved 118, you took away an access to this property that was off of 118.
That's kind of one of the critical elements of this case. It's the state's position that we did not have a legal obligation to do the TLE, that it was something that the state did basically to help improve their driveway access onto 74th Place as part of this overall project.
Could they have gotten emergency vehicles in and out of there if you didn't change the driveway?
We don't know. It's not in the record. And
if they couldn't have, you certainly would have had an obligation to change the driveway, correct?
I don't know about that.
Didn't you have landlocked the property then from emergency vehicles and you got a shopping center there? You think you can do that?
We can't landlock the property, no. To what extent the state has to ensure that local zoning requirements are met, I think is another question, which just we simply don't know in this case.
I don't know what the record would show on the exercise of the police power. I mean, I look at police power, frankly, as the ability of DOT to make a choice to move the road, period, end of story. And I look at how they implement the choice they made as having other parameters. And in this case, I would like you to explain to me why the choice to move the road isn't intricately combined with this limited easement, which was made to expand the driveway.
Okay, so
can I add one thing to that?
Sure.
As answering part of that question, did they have the right to have access to 118 as part of that?
But that's not my question, though, okay. Justice Eagler.
Okay.
If you don't
enough. Answer
okay.
One at a time, we'll first take Justice Rogan-Sack's question, which is, once they've made that choice, isn't that choice to move the road inextricably bound with the LTE? Therefore, what the Court of Appeals said, if it's inextricably bound, you got to pay for it to your state.
Yeah, so I want
you to explain to me why that's not correct.
Okay. Yeah. It's our position that we could have removed the road either way. So if we hadn't redone their driveway, and there isn't good facts in the record on exactly what zoning problems there would be or not, but you can see from the maps that there was access. There was alternate access onto 74th Place before and after the road was moved. It's our position that we could pick up that road, as we do in many cases, without taking any or exercising eminent domain in any way. So here we have two acts. We have an act of picking up a road and moving it, and then we just happen to take a temporary limited easement and exercise an eminent domain power as well, kind of like the Jantz case.
If you didn't take the temporary easement to put a driveway in that was in the public purpose, you abused your rights under eminent domain. So you had to be doing this for a public purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say to me you didn't have to do it, if you didn't have to do it, then it wasn't in the public purpose to do it. I have a little trouble putting all this stuff together.
Well, and you raise an important distinction. I think that you're correct that eminent domain requires a public
absolutely.
Purpose.
Right.
But in this case, the public benefit of reconfiguring their driveway and the benefit to the landowner there and the overall benefit to this overall multi-year, multi-phase highway project is one thing, but it was not a prerequisite to picking up 118th Street and vacating it.
Well, picking up 118th Street and moving it is under the police power. I don't fight with you at all about that. I think you can do that every day. You can move it wherever you want, wherever you've decided is in the public's interest to move it for whatever reasons.
For which no compensation is paid.
That's right.
Your
that's
access
right. That, the choice doesn't bother me. What bothers me is part of the argument that, first of all, you didn't have to do this. And if you didn't have to do it, you shouldn't have done it, because you must have to do it or you can't do it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
I do. It was the reconfiguration of the driveway was something that was determined by the department and the state as being a benefit to the public interest and worthwhile to do in the overall project. We don't have enough facts. The record isn't developed enough to really know why they wanted to do it and the process they got there. What we know is, kind of like the Jans case, that you can exercise eminent domain and police power in the same project, and it doesn't merge those acts. So,
But you see, would you agree with me that the exercise of the police power is simply making the choice to move the road?
It's making the choice to move the road, and also it puts limitations on what a landowner can then claim as damages.
I'm not sure I buy that part of your argument, but I think the exercise itself of the police power is making the choice to move the road. Then the next question is, what do you value in regard to what the landowner lost? And why isn't public access one of the bundle of rights that we talked about in Hastings? Why isn't that one of the bundle of rights that the landlord lost?
Well, and there's case law that I am sure you're familiar with that says it is. It is one of the bundle of rights, but it depends how you get there and how it is removed. When it's removed pursuant to a police power and the act does not take any of your property, there is a lot of case law that says that a property can be harmed and value can be diminished to a certain degree by an act of police power, and no compensation is due. And that's the nature of the police power. Eminent domain is like police power in the sense that it gives the state authority to do things, but there's consequences that we have to pay for that. We have to compensate. The Constitution requires just compensation. Police power is slightly different because it can actually negatively affect the value of someone's property without having compensation be due. And in this case, the act that we did, the Police Power Act of removing that road, was an act that did not affect their property.
Well, removing the road is not what they're arguing about. They're arguing about loss of access to the road. And so it depends on how you parse what you're doing with the police power. If you're moving the road with the police power, that's what DOT is doing. But what the landowner is saying is, you took away part of my bundle of rights. You took away my access.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can do it under the police power. You have absolute authority. But because you took away a property right from me, you can't do it without compensating me. I think that's the argument.
What we would say is that's not completely correct. That the police power, that distinction between eminent domain and police power, does relate to the compensation requirement.
Don't you think they overlap, how they're used? I mean, they're used all the time, and when you're
they're used
roads.
In conjunction a lot, and the state legislature has recognized in 32094 that they can be contemporaneously exercised, and we see that in cases like this. We see that in cases, again, like I've mentioned in Jantz. We're in these big highway projects, a lot of times we're doing more than one thing at once, and so this is one of those situations. It is our position that when we exercise the police power, that limits the amount of damages that a landowner can get as a direct cause of the police
doesn't,
power
act. Doesn't the statute say that you don't get money if you change access? There was a statutory provision.
If you use the
police power, you don't have to pay if you've changed access, as long as you give other access.
Well, 3209 sub 4 does say that.
I don't know if it's 4, but go ahead.
Okay. The subsection 4 of 3209 does say that you don't get compensation unless explicitly provided for. by statute when we're exercising the police power. And if you look at, and it cites to subsection 6, and subsection 6 is a partial taking section. So that's not really where we are because we didn't do a permanent taking, even a partial permanent taking.
For the easement.
Anywhere for them.
But the access is gone.
The access, if you actually look at the photos, their access point is still there, but the traffic outside their access is gone. And I know that seems technical, but it does matter in the sense that we did not affect the boundaries of their property at all. And in most cases, that's not the case. A lot of times, this doesn't come up because we're actually taking a permanent taking somehow. And this case is unique because it involves a temporary limited easement, as the plaintiffs are basically trying to find some way to get compensation for this act of police power of moving the road. And the only thing they have is a temporary limited easement, so they're trying to use that. And it's our position that the Court of Appeals decision is kind of dangerous because it seems to accept that and allow temporary limited easements to be used in this way.
Reading your briefs and listening to your argument, I assume your client, Dot, takes the position that this was simply something involving the flow of traffic, and that is what the heart of the complaint in this matter is. And you point to what looks to be pretty black-letter law that says there is no property interest in the flow of traffic. I have another question, but does that sound
correct?
Okay. And by the way, the record, I think my memory is it was $21,000 that Dot offered to pay. I was curious, reading the briefs, as someone else asked about, why? Why did Dot put the second means of entrance and egress into the parking lot? And I assumed, while I was reading it, that it was connected to a Dot regulation that for some kind of parking lot, I'm assuming, that it had to do with the DOT regulation. The record doesn't disclose whether it was a DOT regulation or local zoning?
It doesn't, and that's, I've talked to a bunch with my client, and really, no, it wasn't pursuant to any regulation. It was, and this is kind of my assumption, it's not in the record, but I think it probably was thought it would be an easier, safer route, but it by no means, and this is where the state's position is, it was not a prerequisite to moving the road, and therefore the TLE should not be able to be held.
Let me ask it another way. If DOT had not put the second means of entrance and egress in, is there anything in the record to show that the landowner would have been required to?
The only thing in the record is the plaintiff's appraiser's statement in an affidavit that without the second entrance there would have been a zoning issue for fire safety. We don't think the appraiser is really qualified to speak to that. He doesn't cite to any zoning section. We don't know of anything that actually would have been a problem by leaving one act. Many properties
have
one access.
And that was offered as part of the motion for summary judgment?
No, this was actually all disposed of in a motion in limine, pretty much. The circuit court granted our motion in limine to exclude all evidence of any loss of value because of the vacating 118th Avenue and the loss of that access. The court excluded all of that and said this is limited to the temporary limited easement we took.
Okay.
And they appealed that, and then we stipulated to dismissal.
I can feel the questions coming from the other part of the bench, so I'm going to stop.
The temporary limited easement is the red arrow and the second.
Correct. That's the new entrance that was created, and the temporary limited easement was basically borrowing their property around that to kind of grade and park on.
Okay. Do I understand your position to be that if there were no red arrow, there had been no compensation at all?
Yes. Because they wouldn't have a vehicle to bring this suit. There are other types of suits they could have brought if they felt that their land had been completely. If they say their access point, their single access point wasn't sufficient, and they felt that we landlocked them or something, they could bring an inverse condemnation claim. But think of it in the larger scheme, where Department of Transportation vacates a road and makes a bypass, a highway bypass, around an area. They simply pick up that road and they create a road around it. It's our position that the state cannot be obligated to spend taxpayer money compensating everybody who has lost the flow of traffic along their land when we're not taking anything, when there's no actual taking going on. We're not the boundaries of the property are the same, and we are not, you know, we're not invading their property at all. So
when you do a bypass around Mount Horeb, and people no longer have to go through Mount Horeb, therefore they no longer shop in Mount Horeb, therefore the value of the property goes down in Mount Horeb, you don't have to pay for it.
No.
And they have you a wide...
Unless there's other...
Yeah.
You know.
Assuming of nothing else.
Right. Correct. And in a lot of cases, I think one of the reasons this case is kind of unique is that we have a temporary limited easement that's actually getting litigated. In most of these cases, a temporary limited easement is coupled with an actual taking of some kind. And so this kind of action will be brought through an actual partial taking of permanent taking. And so the temporary limited easement is not really ever at issue. But this case, it's being used to get these other damages. And the plaintiffs are not only saying that subsection 6G on easements should apply, which we don't think it should, but it's saying that when doing a before and after evaluation to value that TLE, you need to take in the entire highway project. And that would start becoming, in our opinion, rather absurd, because you would get all these permanent damages that were not directly caused in any way by the temporary limited easement. And I see my red light's on.
You do, but I have a question.
Okay.
6G, is that the operative statute here?
That is the statute that the plaintiffs feel applies. And it is our position, and kind of why we are asking this court for guidance on this issue, is that we don't believe that 6G was meant to apply to temporary takings, like temporary limited easements.
Okay. 6G is silent as to whether it's temporary or permanent.
Correct.
So the state, in effect, wants to add the words permanent. It's a case of taking of a permanent easement. And the plaintiff wants to add the words permanent or temporary easement. Because otherwise you have an ambiguity here, an easement, whether you call it latent or patent. I wouldn't have known about the ambiguity without knowing there was a limited easement.
Correct.
So if you are correct that this only covers a permanent easement, then what covers a temporary easement?
That's the question we have. And our position is that the methodology of 6G, the language it uses, the methodology it uses, and its lack of mention of a temporary limited easement means that 6G doesn't apply. So nothing else in Chapter 32 does apply. So we really think it is the best way to value temporary limited easements is to kind of default to the constitutional standard of just compensation. And then finding rental values is what we would say the most logical and really the most common in other jurisdictions way of finding just compensation for a temporary occupation or a temporary taking.
You know, this is a very detailed statute. 32, the whole chapter is detailed. It's been a long time in the statute books with revisions and lots of people working on it. Are there other things that are just not covered in Chapter 32 that you gotta figure out? Or is it? If it's not covered specifically, it's not there. That you understand the point of my question.
I do, and there's nothing else that I can identify for you. I think, I think the reason why this might have been overlooked is that temporary limited easements are simply not litigated very often. Very often, people get a little bit of money, and they really litigate over the permanent taking.
Well, but the statute really doesn't cover every eventuality.
Well,
the whole statute.
Correct.
There are
correct.
Holes in this that are not covered, and then you've got to fit into the statute and into the Constitution. That's my point.
Okay.
Okay. You agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Graupner, representing 118 Street, Kenosha, LLC.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Graupner, and I do represent the property owner in this case. I'd like to begin by responding to several of the questions raised by the court and defer my remarks after that. Justice Ziegler asked, what exactly is plaintiff's claim? Plaintiff's claim is for just compensation as mandated by our Constitution. That just compensation is covered by 3209-6G, clearly says that in the case of an easement, does not differentiate between temporary and permanent. In the case of an easement, the way you measure compensation is by comparing the before value to the after value, assuming completion of the project. That statute is clear, and we are simply asking that it be enforced.
Doesn't that beg the question what the project was here? You're suing on a temporary easement, and your opposing counsel argues in brief and here today that that is the vehicle, so to speak. I'm the only one who finds that pun funny. Well, thank you, Justice Rhodes. Do you see the point?
Obviously, I think you're asking me, how do you define the project?
Yeah, yes.
That is clearly defined by the project plat, which is the document that defines what this project is. It's part of the record. Part of that plat says obliteration of 118th Avenue. So clearly, that action was part of this project.
How so? What do you mean? You say that action.
That action of obliterating.
Well, of course it was. That was the main point. And your opposing counsel is saying, look, we've got pretty long-standing case law that says that your client has no property interest in the flow of traffic. So, okay, so they moved 118th Street. Why doesn't that make the project under the TLE limited to putting the second means of entrance and egress in it?
You've raised several issues, and let me address them. The question of whether or not the plaintiff, a property owner, has the right to a flow of traffic is different than the question of whether the plaintiff, the property owner, has the right of access. And this court held recently in the National Auto Truck Stops case that there is an absolute right to access to adjoining streets. And that is one of the rights that we have in this case, one of the rights that's been taken away.
Oh, so you have, okay, the Chief Justice illustrated by asking about Mount Horeb. Another one that I'm familiar with is the Shawano bypass. Were all those property owners gas stations, hotels, motels, you name it, were they all compensated because DOT put in a highway bypass?
Obviously, I'd need to know the facts before I could answer that, but the auto truck stop case is a very good example. There, the access was changed. It was removed from a direct access to a frontage road access. This court held that there is an absolute right to access that can be taken only by compensating the property owner. And to answer one of Justice Abramson's questions, that remaining access must be reasonable. If it is not reasonable, that's an issue for the jury. Compensation is appropriate.
If it's reasonable access, do you get compensated if the access is changed?
If the finder of fact would determine that the access in the after condition was not reasonable,
then you get compensated.
Then we get compensated.
But if it's reasonable, the fact that it's now frontage rather than direct, you don't get compensated.
I agree with that.
Okay.
However, that's an issue of fact which we have not been permitted to present to the jury. And indeed, our expert witness has testified by affidavit that the access in the after condition is not reasonable.
But the state says you had no, that it's an irrelevant matter because as to the access to 118th, or that the fact that it's gone, it's irrelevant because if you want to fight that, you fight that out as a cause of action. But the cause of action here is that temporarily the state occupied and used part of your property to build a second, I call it road, but a second access. So what you suffered during that temporary easement, says the state, is that you couldn't use whatever the area of the easement was because they were busy digging a road, right? That was your damage. But now you got back the property and you got an access road or an access driveway. And so haven't you been benefited?
Quite the contrary, Your Honor.
Okay.
What this process was an eminent domain process.
Absolutely. But
absolutely.
Under police power, how do you get property? My police power is to get that building, and it's a eyesore and a health hazard, and I'm going to raise it as the state. That's the police power.
Yeah, and there is no evidence on this record that the state ever proceeded by any police power. The only evidence is that they proceeded through the powers of eminent domain.
Well, but how can they do eminent domain if they don't have a public purpose? And isn't public purpose police power?
Excellent point, Your Honor. And the record is clear and undisputed. The TLE was necessary to establish a lawful entrance to this property. That is the testimony of Mr. Hogan. He is an appraiser. Appraisers look at and interpret zoning ordinances all the time. In order to get safety vehicles into that property so as to not landlock it, that access had to be created.
So I think that it has to be an obligation that's in the public purpose, or DOT wouldn't have done it. I mean, I don't think they're even arguing here that it wasn't in the public purpose, because otherwise they couldn't have used eminent domain as they did, right? So they had to build this access to satisfy the public purpose. That part I'm not having trouble with. I'm having trouble with whether you are complaining about the loss of flow of traffic or whether you're really complaining about loss of access. And under our case law, if you're complaining about loss of access and there is other access provided, the question is it reasonable?
True.
Right?
I totally agree. And you make an excellent point that without a public purpose, this would have been unconstitutional.
They wouldn't have done it.
So that buttresses the argument and really contradicts the position that the DOT has taken, that this access is just created for the charity to the property.
I don't think council today said that. I think council today agreed that it had to be for a public purpose or they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, I think the issue about flow of traffic versus access means you're not entitled to perfect access as a property owner. You're entitled to reasonable access. And that's all we're asking for in this case. This court has also said that that's an issue for the jury. Whether the post-taking access is reasonable or unreasonable, that's an issue for the jury. That's National Auto Truck Stop's case.
Why? We have examples here, Mount Horb and Shawano. I live in Wausau, Campus Drive. Just a small, it was a road that needed upgrading, had lots more traffic than was
in Spencer, Your Honor.
That's right. I owned a car wash, right? And so I wanted that access to that busy drive. And darned if when they redid it and got it all super duper, my access to the car wash was on kind of a side road rather than the main drag. I went to meeting after meeting and I said, come on, give me direct access. And they said, no, the overall safety plan flow of the traffic says no, you've got it on the side road. And I wonder, and now I get to my question, what are the ramifications of your argument in terms of all of the people on all of these roads where the direct access is taken, where certainly the business owners want direct
access as I did, but we didn't get it. So what's the ramification, not for your client, but for the overall policy as a whole and the implementation of the policy?
The distinction, Your Honor, is whether or not the powers of eminent domain are used or whether they are not used.
But my boundaries were not touched. Your boundaries aren't touched except for the LTE, right? I mean, they're the same boundaries now.
But this is an eminent domain proceeding. What was taken from our property was pursuant to 8409 and Chapter 32. Once the state...
8409?
And Chapter 32. Once the state invokes these extraordinary powers to take private property, whether it be an easement or 100 acres, they have entered the door of both government rights and private property rights. Those rights are set forth in the statutes, and all we are asking is that those statutes be applied. They don't need to be amended. We're not asking that any language be added. They are required to be liberally construed in favor of the property owner. There are
many
cases. I think
it says liberally construed in favor of the state. What section are you saying is liberally construed in favor of the property owner?
I believe the 260 North 12th Street case is one of a number of cases that say that.
We'll have to look at the statute, though. Go ahead.
Anyway, just to finish the point, the difference is when the state does not invoke the powers of eminent domain, there are different considerations. But that's not the case here. Once invoking those powers, you've got to live by the rights of the property owner.
So if they have police power and they exercise police power and then they need the property to exercise the police power, and they use eminent domain, then they got to pay you.
True. You must follow the statutes. Now, there is no record, there's no evidence on the record of this case that any police power was ever used in this case. The powers of taking 118th Avenue were by the eminent domain, the plat of project.
But they can't do eminent domain if it's not in the public interest. With the public interest, isn't it the same as police power?
Well, eminent domain and police power are not the same thing. Police power requires evidence that such actions were actually taken. Now, in this case, had the state wanted to use police power, there, since this roadway was under the jurisdiction of the city of Kenosha, there is a procedure under 84.295, which the state could have used. It would have required a cooperation agreement, and it would have required an order for a street vacation. None of that happened. At least there's nothing in the record to suggest that. And even if that had happened, the property owner would have been entitled to compensation. So it is the public policy of this state that damages caused by the vacation of the street should be paid to the company.
No, I heard you say something, and if so, then it sort of becomes simpler in my mind. You said, if I understood your argument, it's your client's position that it is not entitled to perfect access to 118th Avenue, which now doesn't exist, but some road, but it is entitled to reasonable access. And that in this case, it did not get reasonable. It's a jury question whether they got reasonable access, and it's a jury question of how much compensation there should be if there's no reasonable access. Is that
I totally agree.
Is that the guts of this case?
Yes, that is, Your Honor.
All right. My understanding of the state, and the state can say whether I'm right, the guts of the state's case is they agree with your legal proposition that a landowner is entitled to reasonable access if a road is moved or obliterated. And then it's a, let's see, they'll agree that it's a jury decides reasonable access and compensation. But it is the state's position that you have to bring a separate action, which you may win or you may lose, and they think it may be inverse condemnation. But that in this action, where they're paying for a temporary easement, LTE or TLE, then for that limited purpose, you don't go into the access issue. You only go into what happened while they're using your property, which for a temporary easement. And so this is a question whether you have to bring, there are two lawsuits here or one. You may win one but not the other.
I'm not sure if that's their position, but okay. My position is that this is clearly covered by the statute.
Which statute?
Which says if they take an easement, the way you measure damages is the before value versus the after value, and indeed the easement statute incorporates the other elements of loss, such as change of access and proximity from 3209 sub 6. It cross-references those as legitimate criterion for consideration in just compensation for an easement. That's all we're asking, that clear statute be applied.
Counselor, what's
part of 6A to G?
Yes.
Which one in 6A
to
G?
I believe B.
Pardon me?
I believe B and E.
Pardon me?
B and E are access and proximity.
So deprivation of existing right of access. Without compensation, okay, under any duty authorized exercise of police power. And the other one is?
E.
Damages are resulting from actual severance of land.
Including damages resulting from severance of improvements or fixtures and proximity damage to improvements remaining on condemnee's land.
Okay.
And that's really what we're talking about in this case.
Counselor, what's the best argument that you can make on this record that your client is not complaining about damages due to a loss of flow of traffic?
I would suggest a reference to the National Auto Truck Stops case.
So I read the cases. I want to know on this record, and I know that we're here on a motion in limine, so the record is not going to be hugely developed. But what I read in the briefs is an argument that your client is concerned because now he can't have drive-by traffic, and those clients that he could have rented to that run with drive-by traffics don't want to rent from him anymore. So to me, that sounds like you're complaining about the traffic going by, not about whether they can get in or out. So I want you to tell me some things that maybe I've overlooked.
Okay. The record includes the appraisal of Mr. Hogan.
Okay.
And he explains that the damages that he calculates are not only from the easement itself, but from the obliteration of the street and the loss of proximity from the shopping center to a street going by. That doesn't have anything.
Loss of proximity is different than loss of access.
It is. There are two factors. Loss of access, he opines, and we certainly agree that the side access to a private road a block from the thoroughfare is not reasonable for this type of use. Proximity relates to the visibility and that sort of thing.
Okay. So you want to argue that for them to give you this access, it isn't reasonable access, but how could they give you any other access if they're going to move the road?
They can give us unreasonable access, but they must compensate the owner for the losses caused by that unreasonable access.
Well, okay, that's fine. I'll go read his appraisal, which I haven't done yet, so I will do that.
So it's all a question of reasonableness.
That is one of the many questions, yes, sir.
If yes, I understand this case, this red arrow access, the state says was not necessary, and you say it was essential.
Well, I believe the position of the state has changed on that issue, Justice Prosser. As Justice Rogensack has pointed out, that taking couldn't have happened unless it was in the public interest or essential. So, ergo, it would have been unconstitutional. Now, we also have other things in the record to indicate the interrelationship between that taking and the closing of access and the closing of the vacation of the street. We have the affidavit of Mr. Hogan, which was never challenged, and states clearly that double-throated access was legally necessary. We have the admission of the department's attorney in the trial court saying he concedes that but for that double-throated access, this property would have been legally landlocked and the property owner would have had an entitlement to a claim of inverse condemnation because, in effect, all of its property had been taken. So the record is undisputed that there is an interrelationship between that taking, the loss of access, and the obliteration of 118th Avenue.
Counsel, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It would seem to me that unless that second access were required by law, the state would be disinclined ever to have a temporary easement because then that would bring you under the 6G statute.
I agree that the state would not have put in this access unless it was legally required. That's just logical. There are many different types of easements taken in these cases, and presumably in each case, the state would not take property unless it needed it. That's what our Constitution requires. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
I'm listening to the analysis of some of my colleagues about eminent domain being only what's required for a public purpose. It seems to me governments are often friendly to businesses and want to assuage the problems that may be created by changes in highways and might want to help a little bit create another access, even though it might not be required, just because they're friendly to business, supportive to business. Why is that clearly not the case here?
Well, it's clearly not the case because it's not in the record. The only thing in the record is to the contrary, that is, that it was legally required. And
that's in the record?
Yes, it is. That's the Hogan affidavit and
from your witness.
The admission of counsel in the trial court. And there's nothing to the contrary. There's no record that this access was not legally required. And again, going back to the point made by Justice Rogensack, if they did this for the goodness of their hearts, it was unconstitutional.
But isn't there the public purpose sometimes advanced by limiting and mitigating any kind of exposure for litigation? So you give a little even if you don't, even if there's an argument made that you don't have to. I mean, we see that in records all the time. I shouldn't say all the time. We see that in records on many occasions when the person who is taking property, the entity that's taking property, is willing to pay much more than their expert said, and maybe even a little more than what might be deemed reasonable, just
to placate, because the overall general purpose, the overall purpose that's in the best interest of the public, is not having it weighed down by ancillary litigation, but getting the project done, getting it done on time, and getting it done on budget.
I agree to the extent that this excess made practical business sense, in that had the state not put that access in, it would have legally landlocked this property, and the state would have been subject to an inverse condemnation action for the entire value of the property, because they would have, in essence, taken the whole property. So it was very expedient. I jest when I say it was done out of the goodness of their heart, because it's clear that it was all part of this project.
When you say legally landlocked, and that phrase was used before, I was under the impression that the facts are, prior to this, that there, before DOT highway construction, that the commercial property had one driveway entrance to the shopping center from a public road, 118th Avenue, and one driveway entrance from a private road that intersected with 118th Avenue. Now, after the DOT highway reconstruction project, the property continues to have two driveway entrances, but both are from the private road, the original entrance from the private road and a newly created entrance from the private road. Are those facts correct, or are they incorrect?
They are correct, and they're shown on the boards. In the before condition on the left, you see the blue is the access to 118th Avenue. The yellow is the access to the private road, 74th Place. In the board on the right, the access to 118th Avenue has obviously been closed. That avenue has been obliterated. It is now replaced by a berm and a sculpture, if you can see it there.
The reason I asked the question was, how come you can say it's landlocked if it still has the original entry from the private road plus another one?
What I'm saying is that but for the placement of the double-throated driveway, it would have been landlocked, because this commercial property requires a double-throated driveway in order to have safety vehicles.
According to your appraiser.
That's right.
How would you write this opinion? What would you say?
I'm sorry?
How would you write this opinion? What would you say?
I would say that one, when government proceeds to take private property by eminent domain, it must follow the rules set forth in the statute.
Well, of course. But what about when they take property by eminent domain under the police power? Then what's the rule?
Well, those are really two distinct concepts.
Okay.
And I think the department is suggesting that they can split up a project and pay for part of it, but not other parts, if they put the label of police power on some aspect of the project. That same argument was advanced in the National Auto Truck Stop case and rejected by this court, saying that you cannot, once you've started down the road of eminent domain, you can't simply relabel aspects of the project as police power and get away with not compensating the private
Suppose
property.
Suppose you fall under 8429, which is part of a controlled access highway, right?
This is not a controlled access highway.
Suppose you did, and you needed property under 8429, which is police power, right? How do you get it if the property owner doesn't want to sell it to you or give it to you? You get it by eminent domain.
Yeah, I think.
So there's overlap between police power and.
There's an interrelationship. Okay. I will agree there. The idea of a limited access highway is a classic police power. It requires a legislative finding, a process. Mm-hmm. To indicate that the government has used its police power. None of that, of course, happened in this case.
Well,
government used only the powers of eminent domain.
Under what provisions in the statute can the Department of Transportation obliterate a road I mean, they just got rid of 1/18, right?
Yes.
Under what power do they have to do that under the statute?
Well, they can do it as part of a project, as they did in this case.
Okay, what was the project?
The project was the entire project plat, which is part of the record, but it involved taking and a lot of takings and a lot of changes to the roadway.
Was any of that limited access or national highway and the 8429 or 8425? None of that.
None of it.
And they don't have to have hearings under this project and make a record that this is what they're doing?
If they had used police power, yes. Because they proceeded under eminent domain, no.
But what about the whole project? I mean, this is part of a big project,
right?
It
is part of a big project.
And in the big project, did they have to have hearings? Did they have to show that it was for the public good? Did they have to give people an opportunity to object?
Well,
people appeal from the project?
There is a process for every project.
That's
what
right.
The state did in this case was act under 8409, which allows them to take property for a highway project, and Chapter 32, which allows eminent domain.
So they acted under 8409, and there's a whole process for doing that, but that's not the police power, in your opinion. Okay?
Counsel, I want to go back to a question that Justice Rogensack had asked, and I want to use National Auto Truck Stops as part of it. In paragraph 9 of that case, the court said, we have clarified that the, quote, deprivation or restriction that Section 3209 specifically refers to is that of an existing right of access, not existing access points, which is all consistent with what you've said. But to be plain, what your clients are complaining of, or what your client is complaining of, is access to 118. Right?
In part, yes.
What else?
Loss of proximity. To
okay. And which will always be there whenever a highway is going to be removed. Unless they're going to, well, which will typically be present when a highway is moved. True?
Loss of proximity, yes.
Yes. And so the court concluded in paragraph 10, therefore, whether there is reasonable access depends on the specific facts in a case. Looking at the facts in this case, how could the department have provided any more reasonable access? And I'm not convinced by your response to Justice Rogensack that, well, they can give us unreasonable access, but they have to compensate for it. This National Auto Truck Stops seems to presuppose that there will be viable or reasonable alternative means of access to the point of transport which the plaintiff complains of. So what could the department have done differently here? How could they have acted more reasonably? Tell me that.
Well, it's not really a question of what they could have done or what they couldn't have done. What National Auto says is if the department is able to provide reasonable access, then no compensation is owed to the property owner. And the question of whether or not this alternative access is reasonable or unreasonable is presented to the jury. And they make the decision as to whether access is reasonable, unreasonable, whether compensation is awarded or not awarded.
How is that not a different way of saying the question that I just asked, which is what could the department have done differently that would have been more reasonable? If they have a duty to provide reasonable access points, right? That's what National Auto Truck Stop stands for.
True.
Okay. How could they have done that in this case?
Well, the project could have been redesigned, I suppose. But again, that's not the critical question. The critical question is if the department has chosen a design and the property owner has no
concern. Okay, so they've chosen to remove a highway in the public interest because whatever studies have been done to show that the public will benefit from the removal and replacement of the highway to a different location. Okay, public interest, there you go. So they should have made an exception for your client's business. That would have been reasonable?
It may have been. We're not objecting. We haven't challenged the tape. We're not objecting to the project. We're saying we're entitled to compensation. And compensation hinges on whether or not the access is reasonable.
The law judges reasonable conduct in a comparative manner. In torts, typically it's the reasonable person standard, which presupposes that there are reasonable alternative courses of action. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe National Auto Truck Stops doesn't stand for that proposition, but that language appears to me to require that Department of Transportation act reasonably and provide the most reasonable access to the highway possible. And I'm not sure how you're demonstrating.
I agree
that
if
they
you
didn't
add
do that.
Or pay compensation to the end of that statement.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that what you're fighting about is what factors can the court look at when it decides what is reasonable compensation, which is why I said to you, I think the fight is between are you complaining about the loss of flow of traffic or are you complaining about getting in and out of the property? Because those will bear on what kind of evidence you can put in to demonstrate that the access is, quote, reasonable. I mean, not just anything you want to say is going to go within the confines of what's reasonable. And I think that, to me, the fight is, when you're putting on evidence of what's reasonable, can you put on evidence that the loss of flow of traffic is damaging this property, so therefore the access isn't reasonable? Or is that outside the scope of what is allowable when you're determining reasonable access? Given that, you can't complain about their moving the highway. They get to do that all day. So I don't know. I may be wrong, but that's where I see the fight.
I'm not...
I mean, you can disagree with me or agree with me because, you know, whatever light you can shed on it. I still have to read your appraisals report, and I tried to get it, but it's going to take a while. So.
I agree with much of what you said. This is an issue of fact for the jury, what the damages are, and we've never been permitted to present that. The appraiser will talk about the loss of value because it's very real. We see it in the types of tenants this property is now able
to attract. But I think it's a question of law about what factors bear on reasonableness. So that may be where you and I are a little different.
This court has said that the question of reasonableness is a matter of fact. And presumably both sides would present evidence on whether or not this access is
reasonable. Well, but that actually brings us back to the original question. Is this a matter of access or is it a matter of flow of traffic? Right. One you recover, one you don't.
Well, if you look at the cases that talk about the flow of traffic, they're generally in this context of access roads, frontage roads, and the cases indicate...
So is National
exactly.
Auto Truck Stops.
Exactly. And the cases say that access is not simply an issue of flow of traffic. I would like to be on the highway because there's more traffic.
Just like Schneider Transport would have liked to have been on the highway.
Correct. And there's not necessarily a right to that, so long as I have reasonable
access. As the Schneider Company found out.
All right. So as long as I have reasonable access, that's as much as I can demand.
Right. Under the circumstance.
Exactly.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you,
counsel. How would you write the opinion?
I would write the opinion by first identifying that this is not an access case. This is a case involving how to value a temporary limited easement, and that when valuing a temporary limited easement, we need to default. There's not a statutory section that tells us how to do that, so we default to the constitutional principle of just compensation, and we determine rental values as the appropriate way of valuing a temporary limited easement. That's what I think this case is about.
So if
that was to be valued as an access case or a flow of traffic case, you do it in another proceeding. Is that your position?
I would. I think that's one of the big distinctions here is the circuit court didn't see this as an access case. The circuit court found that the temporary limited easement here did not affect access. And so it said, you can't bring all of that in. This is a temporary limited easement. It didn't cause any permanent damages. That's what we have to look at here. And that's what the state really contends that this court could do, can stop right there. If this court wants to go on and extend that inquiry, it is our position that any loss of access onto 118th Avenue is just simply not compensable for several reasons. First and foremost being that this is still a temporary limited easement as the vehicle that the plaintiffs are using to appeal this case. And when evaluating a TLE, you cannot bring in these permanent severance damages. Secondly, it's a police power case. And that, you know, the opposing counsel cites National Auto Truck Stop all over the place, but that's not a police power case. And that's a critical difference here. We move this road as an act of police power, and that is the cause, the direct cause of any loss of access to 118th Avenue. And in National Truck Stop, they weren't exercising a police power.
What were they doing?
I think it was a partial taking case, so they had a different vehicle for...
It was a partial taking case.
I think it, if I remember correctly, it was a... Was it a change of grade case? In any case, they lost their direct access to a controlled or to a highway, but it was not a controlled access highway, and it was not
right.
It was not under. And it, as an aside, kind of, I want to clarify too. We talked about the Chapter 84 authority, and I think there was some miscommunication here and some misunderstanding. This case does fall under 84.29, and that's that exhibit that. Justice Abramson, you
No, but in
mentioned.
Response to my question, I thought you said, and I'll have to listen to again, and it's irrelevant. I thought you said it doesn't fall under 84.29.
It doesn't fall under 84.25, which is the controlled access highway. It falls under this National System of Interstate Highways section,
and
which
it's
is
84.29, and
correct.
That's the exhibit.
And sub 7 on that, I think it's sub 6 or sub 7, says that the authority in the statute should be liberally construed in favor of the state.
That's what I thought.
And that is also the section that provides authority to pick up a road and relocate it. So I think we need to distinguish this case from cases like National Auto, where we have different authority. There's a different act going on here.
So it's a police power under 84.29 and is a...
And common law.
And,
yes.
And a procedure. But if you want the property, you've got to take it by eminent domain if they don't want to sell it to you.
Right. When we move a road, we have to buy the property we put it down on, obviously. But we don't have to compensate. In a police power situation, you don't have to compensate for things like loss of direct access as long as there is other access available. And I think that if this case does not need to make this an access case, but if this case does go into that analysis, it really needs to recognize the fact that this is a police power situation, because the termination of reasonableness of access from the state's position is done as a matter of law and does not go to the jury when we're talking about a police power. And
the parameter that would describe reasonableness and what facts could bear on that be set by law? But if you set it by law and there's still a fact question underneath it, doesn't that go to the jury? You know the distinction I'm trying to describe, or am I being too obtuse?
I think so. I think that the case law, and this is the surety savings case law and the similar case law, really says that when police powers need to be separate, they need to be distinct because there's a heightened level of public interest involved here. So when we're exercising a police power, you can change access,
right,
and it's reasonable, unless you're landlocking them or unless there's a situation where they could bring a different type of claim, like an inverse condemnation claim. Say we gave them a new driveway that was 85 miles long. That obviously wouldn't be reasonable, but it would be in a different type of – you would bring it in a different way because we're talking about a police power in this case. So it we need to recognize the fact that this is a police power case if you're going to go to that level, although I think this really can stop where the circuit court took it, which is that we are talking about – borrowing land.
Oh, we have to deal with the Court of Appeals because that's what's up on review before us.
That's true, and that's why we petitioned for review to you, because we think that the Court of Appeals decision is dangerous in the sense that it seems to open the door for any temporary limited easement to bring in all damages from any phase of this overall highway project. That's explicitly what opposing counsel is saying we have to do here, is do a before and after analysis incorporating all phases of this project. Started in 2006 and went till 2011, I think. So there are a lot of things that happened that could affect the value of that property. And it's the state's position that it is simply inappropriate to tack those on to a temporary limited easement that does not take any property permanently and has no permanent effect directly on the property owner. And in this case, benefited the property owner. They got a new driveway. So it's really, this case is really to us about how do you value a temporary limited easement and what is appropriate to bring in. And we think the circuit court got it right.
Well, I have two questions. The first is, does the record disclose how Dot came up with the $21,000?
No.
The second is, your opposing counsel points out that there is an affidavit of a Mr. Hogan. I do remember reading the reference to it. And that Mr. Hogan says that but for the entrance and egress, the driveway, the plaintiff's drive, would not comply with local zoning regulations. And I believe, according to your opposing counsel and my recollection, that's unrebutted.
So it's true that they have an affidavit from Mr. Hogan that says that there would be fire safety problems, I believe he says, fire zoning problems. There's no citation to it, no authority on it, but you're right. I don't believe there's an affidavit that directly challenges that.
And then, well, I guess it's either a third question or a subpart of the second question. How should we deal with that? How should we deal with that, if at all?
Well, I would give deference to the circuit court, who is the fact finder up to this point, who determined that the act of the TLE did not cause any change in access to 118th Avenue. And I think that determination can kind of embody the fact that the circuit court saw all these affidavits and decided not to rely on that.
Well, what I'm thinking is either Dot had to put the second entrance and egress in, someone had to put the second in, and if 118th Avenue Partnership had to, they would have had to have paid for it and presumably sought reimbursement from Dot.
We just don't know if they would have had to put in a second driveway, is I guess the only thing I can tell you. It's the state's position that we're not certain they would have. There's no citation to any zoning code that it would have violated. I don't think they would have.
Thank you. You've addressed my question. Thanks.
Sure. Any other? My red light is on. Is there any other questions?
Thank you, but
all right,
no.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both attorneys Hutz and Graupner for their arguments today and their briefs.
No. I thought he did say affidavits.
Get many, but we get several eminent domain cases in a complex statute with complex fact situations. They are a challenge to the court. So thank you for your assistance. That ends 2012 AP 2784, 118th Street, Kenosha LLC versus the Department of Transportation. I hope it's lunchtime. The court will take a recess from until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. We are in.